Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. Anti-imperialism and anti-imperial resistance is what we're talking about today. We just had the 109th anniversary of Ireland's Easter Rising against the British Empire in 1916. On April 30th, we had the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the end of American imperialism in Vietnam, and the reunification of that country after decades of struggle against multiple colonial empires. Today, Palestine resists. Today, Gaza fights. And Yemen stands with the Palestinians, choking off Israeli trade in the Red Sea and defying a murderous bombing campaign waged by the U.S. Navy and Air Force. And they remain undaunted in their solidarity. In our last episode, and I apologize for being so busy, Israel had yet to resume its genocidal offensive in Gaza. But it didn't take long for the apartheid state and its American backers to do just that. Gaza has experienced 2 months of indiscriminate bombing, starvation, and now a resumption of ground invasions by Israeli troops. These have been met by heroic resistance, and this continues daily as the people fight back against this genocide. And I'm happy to say in China, everybody knows who the good guys are. Everybody, like where I am right now in Nanjing, everybody knows the Palestinians are in the right. Like throughout the global south, everybody knows who the good guys are in this struggle, in this battle, as these Palestinians battle for survival against genocide. You know, the people of the global south are on their side. People throughout the world are on their side. They are not on Israel's side. They are not on the apartheid state's side. Meanwhile, wither Canada, the country of my birth. For once, I'm pleased to say that I was not present to take part in such a pathetic federal election, such a pathetic resurgence of the two-party and first-past-the-post systems that have traditionally done so much to limit democracy in this country. The Liberals have another minority government. The Conservatives came in second. The NDP and the Greens have been crushed. The Liberals have been in power for the past 14 years, the Conservatives before that. All the problems that Canadian voters say they care about have been created by or been exacerbated by successive Liberal and Conservative governments. I mean, let's look at the Abacus poll data for what voters listed as the most important factors determining their vote in 2025. And for a more extensive breakdown, I would strongly recommend watching Dimitri Lascaris, his recent interview on Geopolitical Economy Report, where he goes through all these numbers and what they mean. So according to the Abacus poll data, 45% of voters said that reducing the cost of living was their number one priority. 30% said it was dealing with Donald Trump and the impact of his decisions and actions. 20% said making housing affordable was their number one concern. 19% said growing the economy. 18% said improving the healthcare system. 15% said making Canada a better place to live. 11% said managing Canada's federal debt. 11% said protecting public services. 9% said keeping Canada united. 6% said running an ethical and scandal-free government. 6% said representing Canada internationally. 5% said dealing with climate change. 2% said supporting Ukraine. And 2% said achieving reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. Now, besides that, the disturbing figure that only 2% of voters seem overly concerned about Indigenous sovereignty, it's notable that 45% of people are mainly concerned about the cost of living and inflation, which increasingly is affecting millions and millions of Canadians, obviously. And housing, of course, is up there as well. Both of these things are the result of bipartisan Liberal and Conservative policies going back years, decades. The same is true for public services and healthcare. And yet voters expect these guys, these same guys, to clean up their own mess and have entrusted a banker, Mark Carney, to secure Canada's sovereignty in the face of U.S. aggression. I wanted to laugh when I heard that. It's pathetic. A banker is going to defend Canada's sovereignty. When confronted with a hostile American administration, and obviously Trump has been pretty hostile, he's been pretty aggressive, Canadians turn to the same people who oversaw the cost of living crisis, the resulting homelessness crisis, and the undermining and hollowing out of the public sector. It takes a heavily propagandized population to consider those people the safe option in a time of crisis. And while Palestine wasn't on that polling list, it's worth noting that both liberals and conservatives are firm, both parties are firm in their support of apartheid Israel, while the majority of Canadians are not. Canadian politics are not the politics of solidarity. They are the politics of frightened, isolated individuals who turn to their abusers for protection. And it makes me sad. It makes me sad. I've been in politics. I've run in elections. And it's just so hard to break through the sheer normalcy of it all. But I keep trying. I keep trying because we need people-centered politics. We need socialism, not barbarism. I'd like to return to the subject of Gaza now. I said the theme of this program is anti-imperialism, as it generally is. A new documentary has just been released about the student encampments that emerged in solidarity with Gaza across the states and Canada over the past year. It's called The Encampments. And Kay Pritzker of Breakthrough News, a journalist I have a lot of respect for, played a lead role in its development. And Kay Pritzker was just on the Electronic Intifada this past week. And this is the interview that he had with Ali Abu Nima. This is how solidarity is done, folks. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Kai, as you said, like her work in the film, those shots that she filmed of, you know, the ruins of the Islamic University of Gaza and of you know, the many like vocational colleges, you know, when we'll get into this obviously, but the way that the encampments juxtaposes, you know, these politicians that you're seeing right now, these pundits, you know, saying that people somehow feel unsafe on campus because they hear the word Palestinian, or they, you know, their feelings might get hurt, while places like Al-Isra University, Islamic University of Gaza, are being razed to the ground by our tax dollars, by those, you know, those votes, by those very politicians. The movie itself is incredibly moving. I've seen it twice already, and it's extraordinary. And to center Gaza in the way that it was centered was just so well done.
Thank you. And yeah, I mean, you know, that is really one of the things that was one of the goals of the film, was to sort of recenter or just bring back the focus to what the students were really trying to bring attention to. I mean, the media did such a masterful job of completely distracting from the real issue at hand. You know, it's like, if you watched any of the commentary from the mainstream media, from these pundits, they were talking about all of this, the accusations of anti-Semitism. Oh, it's a den of violence. Oh, these people are bigots. They're hateful. And it's like, none of these people had ever set foot on an encampment. None of them had ever talked to any of the students. And of course, you know, anyone that's been in the Palestine movement, you know, for a long time, or even just the last 2 years, you should know by now that this issue is a distraction. It is, this talking point is a distraction issue. And it is really the central talking point that the Zionist lobby has concocted to just falsely blemish and accuse and slander people as racists and bigots.
We're going to come back to that, but what, let's, since we had just spoken with Rueda, and we wish she could have stayed with us, but let's watch a clip from the encampments, which includes some of her footage and brings that focus to Gaza. So let's take a look at that now.
Israel has destroyed every single university in Gaza.
Yes! Yes!
أهم سلاح لأي أمة هو شبابها الواعي المثقف اللي هيأدي بطبيعة الحال لبنائها. إسرائيل تستهدف المدارس والجامعات والمراكز الثقافية والمؤسسات الثقافية والمسارح والمكاتب، علشان أهم سلاح لأي أمة هو تعليمها. إسرائيل شو عملت من 17؟ إسرائيل دمرت، ولا إيش ضاير في غزة؟
So just for those who are listening, we saw some of the footage that the Israeli army itself published of them detonating, completely destroying several of the major universities in Gaza. And then we saw some of the beautiful footage by Rueda and that interview that she filmed with the journalist Bissan Auda talking about the situation. And that type of footage is interspersed throughout the film, where you always bring it back to Gaza.
Yeah, and you know, this is what the Israel lobby, this is what the Trump administration, this is what the Zionists in America don't want people to see, is they don't want people to see the reality of the matter. They do everything they can to shift the blame or to try to tell people that what they're seeing on their phone screens, what they're seeing on TV, isn't what they're actually seeing, that there's this missing mythical context that they don't understand. And, you know, I think that's exactly why we wanted to bring Rawida into the film, why we had to bring footage from Gaza and show people the reality, because it speaks for itself. And there's nothing in this world that justifies what people are seeing. And people's reaction is exactly the way people should be reacting to a live stream genocide.
Yeah. And Kai, one of the people that the encampments focuses on is Mahmoud Khalil, of course, the Palestinian student leader who was arrested by the U.S. government, Gestapo forces, on March 8th. He remains in prison. He's not been accused of any crime, of course, but the Trump administration is attempting to deport him on the absurd pretext that his advocacy for Palestinian rights interferes somehow with U.S. foreign policy. His arrest was the start of this massive ongoing crackdown. Let's take a look at this clip from the encampments of Mahmoud Khalil speaking.
So can you talk about some of the risks that Palestinian students and other international students take in speaking out and being vocal on this?
Of course, a lot of the Palestinian students here, they feel very uncomfortable, very, very uncomfortable participating and protesting the genocide of their people. That's why we are very grateful for everyone on campus for protesting on our behalf.
And what would happen to you if you were deported?
I will live. We will continue to live. The Palestinian people have been under occupation, ethnic cleansing, and all sorts of crimes since 1948. And we prevailed. We will prevail no matter what will happen.
Yeah, so those were pretty prescient words from Mahmoud Khalil, and they show that the students continued to speak out, even knowing that they faced personal danger. You were there when the students first set up their encampment at Columbia University in New York City, and you caught these moments in the film. And as we know, this inspired similar solidarity encampments on campuses across the U.S. I believe it was 300. And across and around the world. many of which were shut down by police and university administrations with incredible brutality. When you started making this film, did you already understand that you were witnessing something historic?
Yeah, I did. That was, I think, clear from the moment the encampment started to spread after the students got arrested at Columbia. I mean, because really what you're seeing, what the encampments were a referendum, not just on Palestine, but on the ability on the so-called right of the United States to dictate to the world who should live and who should die, who should be in power and who should not. Who has the right to life? Who has the right to water? Who has the right to happiness and education? And who does not? And this was a mass uprising of the next generation. As Ali says in the film, I mean, these are the people who make opinions, who decide the course of history for the next generations. These students who, you know, are expected to fill the shoes of the generals and the Pentagon and the diplomats, rejecting all of the flashy bribes, the little trinkets, the things they wave in people's faces. Oh, you could be a successful diplomat. You could be this. You could have a wonderful job and a career. And the students said, we don't care about any of that, actually. We don't care about your blood money. We don't care about your bribes. We don't care about any of this. All we care about is Gaza, and we're willing to risk anything for it. And I think it was so powerful, not just that it was Columbia students, Ivy League students, but that it was all students across America and the world who were saying, we don't care what you do to us. We don't care how you slander us. We don't care how you, if you blackmail our employers, we don't care about any of that. We support Gaza, and we will take whatever you throw at us.
And Kai, you mentioned that I do appear in the film, which is a great honor for me, and I'm very grateful to have had that opportunity. But really, the students who you just mentioned are front and center in this film. And so let's take a clip that, let's watch another clip that focuses on some of the students who are sort of the main focus of the U.S. side of this film. Let's watch that.
Needed to place pressure again on the administration to reopen negotiations.
We knew that we needed to escalate further. The idea of an occupation of Hamilton Hall along the lines of the 1968 protests was something that people were always sort of considering.
When we felt that there was no further progress to be made in negotiations, in any engagement with administration, then it seemed like the perfect time. Hinds Hall, when it first happened, I think was one of the most joyful moments of my life. The picket was so strong, the chants were so beautiful. It was just like an electric moment.
Hinds Hall is named after Hind Rajab, who was a six-year-old Palestinian girl from Gaza who was assassinated by the Israeli terrorist forces.
She was in a car fleeing Gaza City with an aunt and uncle and some cousins when they were shot at. She was alive while the rest of the family was killed, and she called the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. They dispatched an ambulance to save her. The ambulance and the medics inside were also intentionally killed by the occupation.
And the next part is the full audio recording of Hind, the little six-year-old girl, on the phone with the Palestine Red Crescent dispatch. And that, I mean, that part always, a part always, you know, completely destroys me, and I know a lot of people and the fact that the students stood on the shoulders of the of the, you know, anti-war protesters in 1968 and knew that the occupation of Hamilton Hall was going to be a turning point in their, you know, in their struggle at Columbia, and renaming it after Hind Rajab. It's incredibly moving, and yeah, I don't even. It's gorgeous. Can you talk a little bit about the student leaders that you met while making this film, and you know, those who talked about you know, the steps that they were prepared to take to, you know, to pressure Colombia while they were facing so much pressure, and eventually, you know, as we know, violence from the university and the New York Police Department.
Yeah. I don't think the interviews we shot with some with the sort of main characters, the student leaders, they were 3-4 hours long. I mean, these were very long interviews, and a lot of it, obviously, we couldn't show just for the sake of time, but I wish we could. And I say that because, you know, I think there's this stereotype that's been built by the media, by the Zionist lobby, to say, oh, these students, they're just they're just edgy. Like, they just want to be cool. They just want to skip class. They just want to do something like rebellious. They don't really know what they're talking about. And, you know, you see it in the film, but there's, I just want people to know there's so much more to each of their stories about why they care about Palestine. Like, it is so the opposite of, oh, I just saw a TikTok one day, and, you know, the way they're trying to make it out to be. These student leaders, I mean, this is their life. I mean, you know, you talk about Mahmoud. I mean, this is the story of his family's life for three generations. Yeah. There's no way he can separate himself from this. Same goes for Nye. Same goes for Sueda. Sueda, who is not Palestinian, was so deeply impacted by her trip there that she decided to dedicate the rest of her life to it. I mean, these are people that, it's not just knowing the issue of Palestine. I mean, they don't see themselves as separate from the Palestinians. They don't want to live in a world where they just go to work and they live their life while people are being bombed and killed. They see themselves and their lot in life as one with the people in Gaza. And yeah, I mean, I say that to say, I wish we could share the whole story, but these students are completely selfless in their devotion to Gaza and Palestine.
It's really, I mean, it's an you know, we're just showing some clips so people can see the incredible filmmaking, but the emotional experience of watching this film with other people in the movie theater was very intense. It's really extraordinary. Let's take a look at another clip, and this is of someone who is, their identity is hidden, but we'll get you to talk about that afterwards. But let's watch that clip.
I was approached on campus by several students. They were concerned that the deaths of Palestinians would be minimized, if not just completely ignored, in the statements coming out from the school. And I asked them what they wanted me to do. And they said, could you just please start putting some numbers into these statements? You know, absolutely acknowledge the Israelis who have lost their lives, but also could you please put in the number of Palestinians lost their lives, just so people can see. I brought that back to my boss, and what they said to me was this: who are these students? And I said, well, I didn't get their names. And they said, no, who were they? And I said, well, it was a couple women, and there was a man. They said, do I have to spell it out for you? What did they look like? What color was their skin? Were they wearing scarves? And I didn't feel comfortable answering that question. Then I was admonished and told to not fall into a, quote, skewed perspective that I would be getting from students throughout this crisis.
So, yeah, what are we watching there, Kai?
So this is one of the administrators at Columbia who was intimately involved in the communications of the university after October 7th. And this is someone who was not like a, you know, like a Palestinian activist. This is someone who was not, you know, such a someone who was like immediately, you know, immediately on the side of the students or anything like that. And in drafting university communications was told over and over and over to basically skew all the communications to exclude any relevant context that, you know, Israel was blockading Gaza, that they had been pursuing a genocidal policy there for years and years and years, about the occupation, about the Nakba, and basically was just skewing the university's perspective all to the side of Israel. And, you know, this person felt so compelled or so moved by the bias and the slant of the university that they started speaking out on some other podcasts. That's how we found this person, is we heard a podcast that they were participating on, and we asked them if they wanted to be in our film to tell the same story. And yeah, I mean, this interview basically tells you exactly what we all knew was happening, which is that Columbia University is absolutely conscious, aware, and intentionally skewing their communications, skewing all of their policies, skewing the enforcement of their policies towards the pro-Israel student groups on campus and towards their pro-Israel donors. There were a lot of parts of this interview also that we didn't have time to include, but you know, maybe that's something we should do, is bring out more of this interview later.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Maybe, you know, in the old days we'd say that would be in the DVD, but maybe you can put up a website with some of these incredible interviews.
Yeah.
And Kai, just since the film has been released, it's been having a really big impact. It's been the many showings across the U.S. have been sold out. It even gathered interest from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, not surprising. And one of their journalists tried to interview. You made a video about that for Breakthrough News about what happened. And we're just going to watch about the first minute and a half of your video. It's actually 11 minutes long, and people can go find it at Breakthrough News. I highly recommend it.
It's fantastic.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
But we're just going to watch a little bit of it now.
Israeli newspaper Haaretz tried to run a hit piece against us, decided they didn't like my answers mid-interview, and hung up on me. Luckily, I recorded the whole thing. Chuck Yoked, a New Jersey-based writer for Haaretz, emailed me last week asking if he could interview me about our film, The Encampment, which is about the student movement in solidarity with Gaza. I agreed, and we set up a Zoom call. But as soon as the interview started, his first question was, why didn't you include anything about the Jewish students at Columbia who were spit on and assaulted? And I said pretty plainly back, who are these students? And there was dead silence. And he tries asking this again, same thing. And at this point, I noticed he wasn't actually running a recording on the Zoom call, but was instead typing down what I was saying. So out of an abundance of caution, I started running a voice memo on my end. And this is where it starts.
I mean, what happened? I mean, tell me about it. I mean, I'm curious. I don't know about who was spit on, which Jewish students were spit on.
Okay.
After I asked him more to tell me about this alleged anti-Semitic spitting incident, he tells me to read Columbia's report about it.
For example, there was a report at Columbia University after that the way they handled anti-Semitism, and they admitted they failed in the way they handled that.
At this point, it should probably already be clear that this guy hasn't read the report himself, because if he had read the report, he would know that in the 91 pages, there are two quotes from students who claim they were spit on, and there's no actual evidence it happened. There are no photos, no videos, no verifiable testimony. Mind you, during those 2 weeks, Columbia's campus was probably the most photographed and videographed square mile on the planet. Yeah.
So, talk about and again, that whole report you did, it's 11 minutes, where we hear more of this ridiculous conversation with the Haaretz reporter. And you just did this incredible job of dismantling his propaganda. And it's amazing. It's so good. But really, the question is, he came into that interview saying, why didn't you show all these anti-Semitic incidents that happened? And this is, of course, addressed in The Encampment. So my question to you, Kai, is how much anti-Semitism. I mean, let me put it this way. If you look at any mainstream media coverage of Columbia and other campuses, it's taken for granted that there were, in fact, anti-Semitic right. attacks on Jewish students. What's the reality that you found, particularly at Columbia?
Yeah, I mean, this was, it was honestly one of the most jarring things about the coverage and the narrative that they were able to spin and convince people actually that there was like, there was this atmosphere of anti-Semitism or hate. I mean, it just goes to show if you repeat a lie enough, like it becomes true. And that's really what we set out to debunk, because there was no anti-Semitism. Like, you know, it is remarkable because, you know, the whistleblower says, and I say in that video, but really, I mean, the Columbia campus was being filmed 24/7. And it's like, if it was even a fraction of how you're describing it, that it was this, you know, den, this cesspool of anti-Semitism, there must be some evidence, but I haven't seen any. In fact, I went out to watch the October 8 film, you know, which is the pro-Zionist film.
God,
that's
I'm
in
so
theaters.
Sorry. Yeah.
I had to, you know, see what the opposing narrative was. And even in that film, there's not a single legitimate anti-Semitic act in that film. What there is, however, is students at Columbia or other campuses saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. People saying free Palestine, wearing keffiyehs. And that was one of the parts that the whistleblower actually talked about, is he was responsible for tracking some of these anti-Semitic incidents, which Columbia has this whole log of anti-Semitic incidents that took place at Columbia. And like almost all of them are related to like, someone said free Palestine in my vicinity, someone right. in my class wore keffiyeh, someone, you know, said that we should read this Palestinian book. Apparently there was one person that actually complained that there was a Palestinian student in his class. So it's like, I mean, it is absolutely remarkable, but you know, the truth is the opposite. The truth is that the Columbian encampment, as well as all the encampments around the country, so many of them were full of this new generation of young anti-Zionist Jewish students, and you know, anti-Zionist Jews in general, who are beginning to realize that Judaism has nothing to do with having a Jewish supremacist ethno state, and that actually Jews, you know, can be perfectly happy and safe in, you know, America and other places, and that it's actually Israel that's making them unsafe by bombing schools, bombing hospitals, and then saying this is the most Jewish thing ever. So, you know, I mean, it's an absurd yeah. narrative for sure.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's like complete gaslighting on a massive scale, and yeah, it's. It's ridiculous.
And just one more thing, yeah. if yeah, I can yeah. add, I mean, if you meet some of these students and you talk to some of these people who are trying to perpetuate this narrative, I mean, I don't think it takes too much common sense or too much intuition to see that this is really a performance, like, and it has always been a performance by the Zionist lobby and, you know, Zionist advocates in the United States. They perform this, oh my God, I'm so hurt, I'm so scared, I'm yeah. so this, that, and the other.
Victimized, and, yeah.
Right. And it's like, you really just on one hand, you're talking about people who are saying like they're being hurt by words or like being told that they are supporting a genocide. Meanwhile, the students on the other side are protesting an actual genocide. Like the disparity between the acts or the so-called violence that's being discussed is like tremendous. And I think, you know, the fact that one side is talking about an actual genocide and like 80% of all structures in Gaza being destroyed, the entire health system being destroyed, the entire education system being destroyed. And the other side is saying like, yeah, I can't support yeah. my genocidal ethno yeah. state anymore without being called like names. It's like, wow, right. this is insanity.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It completely is. And then of course, you know, the university administrations, obviously, after last year's student intifada, you know, over the summer, it's very clear that, you know, they kind of coordinated these attack plans to, you know, enact these policies and mandates for potential student protests on their campuses. I mean, here in California, the University of California system has, you know, banned masks and said that all protests need to be pre-approved. You know, of course, now they're trying to say that even the word Zionism in a, you know, as if you criticize people and use the word Zionist in a derogatory way, whatever, that that can be considered racist and a hate crime. And we see also physical violence once again happening by cops on student protesters. Just yesterday at UCLA, there was a screening of the encampments, which took place on the day, I think it was the very day to the year, you know, a year ago to the day, when UCLA cops and Zionist thugs assaulted the encampment at UCLA. So they, so the UCLA students then were going to show a screening of the encampments about UCLA cops beating protesters. And then what happened? This is from last night. The UCLA called the cops again and had the students attacked. Like, how do you make sense of this? What's your reaction to how administrations are kind of doubling down on their thought crime policing of student and, you know, student activity on campuses?
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, it's like I kind of marvel at the absurdity of just, they really have not learned their lesson. Like, they are doing exactly what the started the whole encampment movement in the first place, the arrest of the Columbia students, which is, you know, this repression and censorship, which was so outrageous to the entire world that they decided to follow the in the steps of the Columbia students. But on the other hand, like, it makes perfect sense. And this is what we've been saying from the beginning, is that, you know, what the encampment movement really showed is that the students and the future generation, the Palestinian movement, has won. It has won the narrative. It has won the battle for the narrative. It has won the battle for hearts and minds. The Israel lobby, Israel has completely lost its legitimacy in the realm of public opinion. I mean, there was that poll that said for the first time, Americans have a majority negative view of Israel. And this is only going to compound as more of these, you know, these students, these younger people take, you know, positions in society and sort of, they are the future. And this is really the natural, this is the logical end game of Zionism. I mean, because they've lost the narrative, because they've completely lost public opinion, the only tool they have left is outright repression. The only tool they have is censorship. The only tool they have is to say, you actually can't talk about Palestine anymore. We're going to make it illegal to talk about Palestine. We're going to deport you if you talk about Palestine. And apparently now we're going to arrest you, beat you, send riot cops on you if you even watch a movie about Palestine or about the encampments. I mean, it's they're so afraid of just they're afraid of the act or just the existence or the acknowledgement that Palestine exists, that people support it. So I'm not surprised that UCLA did this. I'm not surprised that there was this coordinated push to attack the encampments. And, you know, it's also worth noting that this kind of just it just kind of proves the point of the film, which is that all of these universities are controlled by private donors. And whatever the private donor's agenda is becomes the agenda of the university. And for many of these universities, the donors support Israel. They're these rabid racist Zionists. So then that becomes the agenda of the university. And all of a sudden, millions of dollars, you know, people, these riot cops hired by the universities, are all the money of the university is being spent to like beat the crap out of students because they decided, because they are beholden to their Zionist donors.
Yeah, it's so clear. I know these, we say it over and over again, but these universities are more interested in their, you know, in their endowments than they are in actually doing. And this is what Mahmoud Khalil says in the film too. You know, instead of being a university where people come to learn and talk and you know, examine and, be with other people from all over the world and learn from them, they're more like a hedge fund. And so what the students were doing, you know, as Mahmoud Khalil says, is trying to return the university back to its foundational roots of being a place and not a bank. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
It's an incredible film. Kai, just before we let you go, I know that many people, after listening to you and seeing these clips, will want to see it. Where and how can people see The Encampments?
Yes. So The Encampment, we just more or less finished our theatrical run. There's still a few theaters around the country that are running it, but we're doing sort of campus or community screenings now. So we want you to basically show the film, to get the word out there. We made this film as a tool for the movement to show people people who don't know the truth about the encampments, the truth about Palestine, the Palestine movement, and the people that support it. So we have a form on the Watermelon Pictures website. It's a screening request form, and you can go there and fill out the form, and they will get in touch. Watermelon Pictures, who was our distributor, who's fantastic. This film wouldn't have been what it is without them. They will be in touch with you and help you screen the film, whether it's at a college, your local community center, wherever you might gather with your friends and family. So you can go there and get a screener for the film. And then, you know, down the line, it'll be available on streaming platforms and stuff like that.
And it is, as you said, it's just finishing a theatrical run where it was in cities across the United States. It was sold out. Every showing was sold out in Chicago. And I know that it was the same across the country. If there are still some theatrical screenings, they will be listed. People can find that out at The Encampments website. If you just, search The Encampments film, you'll get to the website. And if you can get into the theater and see it, I highly recommend it. This is really an extraordinary film. Kai Pritzker, you are the co-director of The Encampments with Michael Workman, and you're also a reporter for Breakthrough News. And we are so grateful to you for the work you're doing and for the time you've spent with us on the Electronic Intifada live stream today. Thank you for making this film. And I hope people will take you up on that and try to get this film shown in their communities. It's incredibly powerful.
It is.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to be on here, and thank you for all the work you do. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Incredible work.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!